So you can imagine that if you're hiking mountains all week, that the sermon is going to be about that. I knew I was going to be out of cell service and any sort of contact with Phyllis before she needed to get the bulletin in, so I made a quick decision on what title I was going to title this sermon, and it has nothing to do with the actual sermon, so forget it. But you're probably used to that by now for me. Come to find out, backpacking comes with all sorts of little surprises, especially if you don't do it very often, but I would think it's kind of always the case. So, little surprise number one. If there is such a thing as mosquito attractant, then I wear it. I wear it. So, I think it was this past January when my buddy Colin, who we went to school together up in Dayton, he lives in Philly now, he called me, and he got bumped off a flight, you know, back last year sometime, and they gave him a voucher, and he's like, dude, I have this $700 voucher. We should go hike Yosemite. I said, you're on. Let's do it. I had assumed that that $700 voucher would cover my flight and things like this. It didn't, but I was game. We were going to do this. All right, so neither of us had been to Yosemite. And I hardly see him anymore, so this seemed like a perfect idea to do. So last week we were out there. We got out there Sunday night. We stayed in Fresno Sunday night, and then on Monday we drove out to Yosemite. A buddy of ours from San Diego came up and met us, and we drove out in his truck to Yosemite. We saw the big sequoias that are down there, which was fantastic, and then we drove into the valley. We drove into the valley. The next day, we woke up and we went to this this hike. We started our backpacking trip and a hike, and none of us knew what we were doing, and so we way overpacked in food, which meant that I was carrying around like 10, 15 more pounds than I ever needed to, which means that in about 10 years, David is going to get a lot of money out of me. And so that's probably true. And so, all right, but we started on this creek called Murphy's Creek. And it was beautiful, it was lovely. We were hiking along what were called the Polydome Mountains, which are these, if you know anything about that area, the Sierra Nevadas in California, it's all these big domes, these rounded granite mountaintops, all right? We were hiking along there. And our plan was to, the next day, then come down into the valley area, and on Thursday, we were gonna hike Half Dome. All right, Half Dome is that, literally Half Dome that you see in all the iconic California Yosemite pictures, all right? It's the big one. It's the one everybody wants to hike up. We were going to do this. We were going to rock it. It was going to be awesome. That was the plan. We had no idea what was coming. Not a thing. No idea. Something like 2 miles in, we ran into our first little surprise. And as you probably guessed, it was an apocalypse of mosquitoes. I'm not kidding. There were clouds of them. Clouds. All right? They started to swarm us. You had to keep walking, practically running, just to survive. All right? It's like Moses had called down some sort of plague. All right? These things learned how to eat through my clothes. I had blood smeared across my back from slapping them. All right? This was gross. In one sense, though, it was perfect because Gary and I had picked up a book that week called The Mosquito, all right? A Human History of Our Deadliest Predator. And I can tell you from experience that this book is true. Haven't even read it. All right? We even stopped to eat once, all right? And the whole time we're eating, we're walking around in these large circles, eating like this to stay away from the bugs, all right? It was just miserable. Where we camped, I thought, okay, we're out in the middle of nowhere. There's no water around us. It's just a big bunch of rocks. We're going to camp here. There was a breeze blowing. By the time we make camp, the breeze had stopped and mosquitoes had found us. My friend Luke was sitting cross-legged on the ground, and they would just sort of like swarmed his legs. They were crawling. He could just smear dozens of them by running his hand across them. How do you live in a place like that? I remember seeing the ranger afterwards, and she goes, hey, how are the mosquitoes? I was just like, you didn't tell me. And so it was bad. It was bad. So, yeah, they're a product of the fall and sin, and there's nothing to do with them in heaven. So don't worry about that. Thankfully, though, not every surprise on our trip was like that. When we started out, right when we were starting up that creek I called Murphy's Creek, all right when we were starting out, we stopped off a little bit for lunch. Because we got a little late start, we stopped off a little bit for lunch, and I realized I really had to go potty. And I'm going to say potty here because that seems like the polite thing. I had to go potty. We're backpacking. I'll leave it to you to decide how you go potty in the wilderness. All right, so I needed to go. We stopped off this little stream. So I just go off into the wilderness a little bit to find some privacy. I head in the woods with this little spade, and I all of a sudden stumble may be a weird word, but I stumble upon this massive, gnarly-looking tree. It's all sort of like twisted in on itself. It looks super old. Its bowl was probably as big around as my kitchen. All right, this thing is huge. It's stubby, though. It's not super tall like a sequoia, but it's stubby. I found out later it's called the Grand Sierra Juniper, you know, Sierra Nevada's Grand Sierra Juniper. California's known for these great sequoias, but I thought this juniper was fantastic. All right, it was just awesome. One of the coolest trees I'd ever seen. Apparently, there's one, it's called the Bennett Juniper. We didn't get to see this, but it's supposedly somewhere between 3,000 and 6,000 years old. This tree, still alive. Can you imagine that? It was old when Jesus was in diapers. That's old, all right? So these are the kind of surprises you sometimes get backpacking. You discover 3,000-year-old trees that are alive before the Creator even became a creature when you go off to the potty, you know? So you gotta pay attention, I think. One of the lessons I learned, you have to pay attention to these little surprises that come up to you in the midst of backpacking. That's half the fun of it. Which brings me to our reading from today, a reading from Luke. The short and sweet of our reading from Luke is that this is Jesus in lecture mode. He's lecturing. And what really sticks out to me about this passage is how insistent he is that we pay attention. He says, pay attention to what's going on around you, right here and right now. The last thing Jesus seems to want us to do is to miss the big high mountain juniper next door because all of our focus has been on checking out the giant sequoias or on making it up Half Dome. He says, sometimes the little surprises are the best thing. All right, so don't get distracted. All right, the problem, however, with this passage that we have for today is that it's distracting itself. Because when we read it, we're all distracted by the beginning when Jesus says that he's going to bring fire down from heaven and he's going to cause division among everybody. That's some tough stuff, and we want to know how in the world is this possible. But it's what he says after that. It's what he says at the end of our reading that's really been gnawing at me all week. Here's what he says. Luke 12, 54 through 56. Feel free, actually, to get out your Bibles. If you don't have one, they're in the back of your pew. All right, turn to page 848 if you're using that Pew Bible, and you'll see where we are. This is what Jesus says. He says, when you see a cloud rising in the west, you immediately say it's going to rain. And so it happens. And when you see the south wind blowing, you say there will be scorching heat, and it happens. You hypocrites, Jesus says. Strong language, you hypocrites. You know how to interpret the appearance of earth and sky, but why do you not know how to interpret the present time? Why do you not know how to interpret the present time? Luke puts this lecture of Jesus in the middle of his gospel. All right, Jesus is about to suffer and die. He's on his way up to Jerusalem. In verse 50, he tells us that he has a baptism in which he has to be baptized. This is what he's talking about. He's talking about his death, this type of baptism. He's talking about going to die. Maybe the folks around him, maybe his disciples assumed things were going to just get more and more rosy as things went on, that life was going to get easier and easier as people began to realize just how amazing Jesus was with all of his miracles and healings and feedings and things like this. But Jesus is saying that the gospel doesn't always work that way. The author of Hebrews tells us that this gospel, this good news of Jesus Christ, it's living and active. It's sharper than any two-edged sword. It pierces into our very hearts and minds. You don't use language like that, right? If you're talking about something that's soft and cuddly, that everybody can agree upon and doesn't really change anything. The good news that we call Jesus Christ might be about peace. It might be about hope. It might be about what it means to be truly and fully human, but the one thing it is it's not easy. The gospel is not easy, Jesus is saying. Change and growth are never easy, he says. And then he says this should be obvious. It should be obvious. The people have seen how the religious leaders have responded to Jesus' ministry, and they didn't respond well. If there was anybody who should have seen the truth in Jesus' words, it would be them. It should be the people whose job it was to lead everyone to God, but they don't respond well. You can look at the end of the chapter before ours, the end of chapter 11. Luke tells us in that place that Jesus left there, and the scribes and the Pharisees began to be very hostile to him and to cross and examine him about many things, and they even lied in wait for him to catch him in something that he might say. They wanted to find a reason to persecute. Well, they wanted to find a reason to make him quiet. It's important to remember that these folks, the Pharisees, the scholars, the scribes that Luke calls them, they weren't really these obstinate, self-seeking folks that we tend to make them out to be. They weren't. Most of them had the people in mind. Most of them were honest. Most of them were genuinely trying to be the best that they could be. All right? It's like most, I think, church leaders today, trying to be the best that we can be, wanted the best for the people. But Jesus was bringing change, and he was teaching new things, and all of it was being divisive. If I'm being honest, I'm not quite sure I'd be on Jesus' side either. I don't really like division. It kind of makes me squirm a bit inside. I have a hard time thinking about how I'm supposed to keep together this image of an all-loving, compassionate God who also brings fire down upon the earth. That's weird. I don't know what that's supposed to look like. But if it's the case, then what Jesus is saying is that I'm not just being naive here. I'm being a bit blind. I'm not paying attention, he says. I'm not paying attention to what's actually going on around me. He might be saying I'm an idealist. And he says, Jason, you need to be a realist. And there's a lot of complexity to those terms, so let them just sort of stand on their own basicness. But Jesus is saying, Jason, just look. Just look, this gospel thing, it brings division. So look, can't you see what's going on? Can't you see the way that the work of God is being done in the world, what's happening right outside your door? This is what Jesus is trying to say to his disciples. Part of the struggle of being disciples, part of the struggle of being the church, is that we're all a bunch of idealists, I think. We're all a bunch of dreamers, to put it that way. We're always pushing towards something bigger and better. And who can blame us? This is the American dream. Bigger, better. All right? But dreams like that often, not always, dreams like that often blind us to the present, though. Everything we have is focused out there, into the future, on something else, on what might be, what could be. And that could be something beautiful, but it's not what's here. And that's what Jesus is saying is important. It's important. We have a hard time seeing how God is working in us and around us right this minute, because we're so focused in the future. We've made the future into an idol, even. Dietrich Bonhoeffer is this German theologian who died in a Nazi concentration camp. He's become really popular recently. One of his books, he writes that God hates visionary dreaming. God hates visionary dreaming, which sounds really counterintuitive for like somebody in the church to say, no visionary dreaming, right? God hates it. So why does God hate visionary dreaming? When Bonhoeffer said this, he said it to a bunch of pastors in churches. The problem really is not so much the vision or the dream. The problem is that we start to love that vision. We start to love the dream more than anything else. What we do is begin to love the potential. We begin to love a potential church or a potential community more than the church or the community that we see right here, more than what we actually have, more than what God has given us. So the here, the right now is the world in which God is working. And it's in this world that he calls us to work too. And sometimes our vision and our dreams, they can blind us to where God is actually living and moving because they cast our vision too far into the future. And we don't see what's going on in the present. We don't see what's going on right here. So next week, we're starting a new series called The DNA of the Local Church. All right? Our church. For 3 weeks, we're going to be looking at what it means to be WBC, Wyoming Baptist, right here on the corner of Burns and Waverly. We're going to be looking at this. Ironically, we're going to be talking about vision and mission and action, which by this point, you should probably be like, Jason, you should just change your terms. You've blown it up. But we're going to keep them. But this is why I wanted us this week to make sure that we don't get lost in all the dreaming. We can't get lost in all the dreaming. Because no matter what our vision is, no matter what our dream is, we can never lose sight of the simple fact that we are already the church. Right here. Right now. And we can't be ever more than it. We're already it. All right? We're already the church of Jesus Christ. We're already the people of God called to love the world of God. And we'll never be more the people of God than we already are. Here's what that means. That means that first and foremost, we have to pay attention to human faces. Human faces. It means paying attention to the people in the pews next to you. Because they're your church. All right? It means paying attention to the people in the faces that are eating and sleeping and walking on the roads next to here. That are your neighbors, wherever you live. These are where God is working. Don't cast your vision so far forward that you miss those faces. Because then you miss where God's working. So it means paying attention to how God is already moving in our neighbors and our neighborhoods and joining in where God is moving. It means becoming a part of what God is doing right now in our little corner of the world instead of dreaming about somewhere else that's not even here yet. Because if we dream about that, then we're actually not being the church. We're just trying to become our ideal. So when my two friends and I were hiking out of the woods on Thursday afternoon, I believe it was my friend Colin, the one from Philadelphia, who asked what our favorite part of the trip was. He was a bit depressed, actually. The day before, we had been hiking down out of that Murphy Creek mosquito-ridden area, for goodness sakes, thank you. We were hiking into the valley. Well, to get there, you had to go down into a deeper valley, and then up a mountain, and then down into the valley. And going up that mountain was like a mile or two of pretty much straight up. And we were wearing really heavy packs and way too much weight because we didn't know what we were doing. It was a beast. And we thought we would find water up there because we don't know what we're doing. And we didn't. So he got dehydrated. And then he got sick from dehydration. And so we were happy that we were able to find some water and save the guy's life. I don't know how close it got, but he was like dry heaving. This is pretty bad. Anyways, he's not doing well, but we find a place to rest a lot sooner than where we hoped to get. But it was so far back that Thursday, the next day, when we were trying to do Half Dome, all right, the big iconic Half Dome, we're trying to do it, we're too far away. All right, we can't get there in time. We're already worn out by the time we get to the foot of Half Dome. So we just can't do it. It would have been death, probably. And so we decide we're just going to go into the valley. So we finish out the hike. We go into the valley on Thursday instead of doing Half Dome. And he's depressed. He feels embarrassed. And he asks, hey, so what's your favorite part of the trip? What's your favorite part of the trip? So it got me thinking. Obviously, it wasn't Half Dome. We didn't do it. I liked the sequoias. I loved those big high mountain junipers. I hated the mosquitoes. That was an easy one. All right. I think the best part of the trip was the sheer fact that I did all the things that we did do with those two guys. That was the best part. I realized I didn't really care about hiking Half Dome. I could have done it because I was fine. But if Colin wasn't going up, I didn't really want to go up. It wasn't that important to me after that. And so, see, already my memories of this trip were becoming less about the scenery, which was amazing, all right? But it became more about who I was enjoying the scenery with. I didn't want to take selfies. I wanted to take group photos. There's something about that. So it was the fact that we were experiencing these things together that was my favorite part of the trip. That was my favorite part. It's really the same thing with the church. Bonhoeffer's big point is that what it means to be church is the simple fact that we live life together. That's the title of his book where this comes from, Life Together. Our dreams, our visions can become idols and distractions when they blind us to the fact that what's most important in being the church is the people who are part of it and the God who made and loves it. That's what's most important. So over these next couple of weeks, when we begin to talk about the DNA of the church and our mission and our vision and our actions, you're going to I hope you're going to be tempted to come with a sense of anticipation. But I'd rather you come with a sense of gratitude, thankfulness. Thankful for how God is already right here, working among us and in our neighbors. Thankful that we're invited to be a part of this work. And thankful that we can be a part of it together. Because that's being the church. In the end, that's our vision. That's our mission. That's our action. To do these things together.